from the redwood forest to Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to The People Speak live on BBS Radio every Tuesday night at 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, or by going to our site, thepeoplespeakradio.net. There you can also listen live to our past shows on our iPod Ready Archive section. And the site, again, is thepeoplespeakradio.net. If you have a Nokia phone, you can also listen live via satellite. So just go to the website for details. Tonight's guest, Robert Allen Savage, is a good friend of mine and someone I'm honored to know. He is here to introduce his book, It Ends With Me. This is a story of human tragedy beyond humanity. It is a story of what we do to those we claim to love so much, our children, and how we show them that life, love, and humanity are not to be trusted. Hello, Robert. How are you?
I'm good, Basma. I'm good. How are you?
You are good, actually, and I am great. And it's an honor and a privilege to have you here. I think what you're doing is unbelievably courageous. As a victim of child sexual molestation at the hands of a perpetrator, a neighbor of ours, I know a lot about what you're talking about. In your own words, Robert, you write, writing under the pen name Robert Savage, I am a survivor of the worst, believer in the best. I live my life to spread a message. You can heal. Abandoned, adopted, dumped into the system, I spent 23 of my first 27 years institutionalized. Can you tell us, Alan, why you wrote this book?
Well, first of all, I wrote the book to let people know that there is a way out. No matter how dark it seems, no matter how bad your past was, there comes a time in your life where you run out of excuses. When you run out of excuses, you realize you have to heal. And writing it, secondly, helped me heal from a lot of issues that I refused to address for many years. So the book serves two purposes. It serves, one, to help me heal, and two, to get a message out there to other people who may be suffering, who feel alone, who feel like there's nobody that understands. Let them know there are people that understand, that you're not alone. You've just been put in a corner and told you're alone, and that together we can all get through this, and we can get to a better day.
Well, it's awfully courageous of you, Robert, and you know, I sit here and I think about these issues that you wrote about. The book is raw. It's painful. It's painful to know that someone that I know has gone through this, and yet it reminds me of the days of recovery when I too was healing from so many things in my life that you know, that there is something at the end of the tunnel, that there is a light, and that you can heal from this stuff, and that you, although nothing can ever take the crime away, you don't have to be a victim anymore. And I think that is so huge. But let me ask you, Robert, unfortunately, it may have ended for you, but there are millions of children still locked up in the system, out in the streets and exposed to the worst crimes against humanity. For many children, it does not end. How do we deal with that?
Well, first of all, I think what we need to do is we need to stop turning our heads. I mean, anybody who's been through abuse, they know the look in the eyes. And we as a society have to stop turning our heads. We have to be the voice for our children. Unfortunately for children, once they get put into the system, they're already deemed as unreliable. They're deemed as incorrigible. They don't have a voice. And we as a society need to stand up and say, you know what? Enough of this. Enough of people in trusted positions hurting our children. Enough of one child living on the street. enough of one child being introduced to drugs at 11 years old, prostitution at 12. We as a society, it's a social problem. It goes much deeper than just the child affected. We have become numb to what happens to our children. If it doesn't affect us directly, we seem to walk away. And what we need to stop doing is we need to stop looking into those broken eyes and continuing about our way. We need to take a moment and do something. We need to make a call. We need to tell somebody. We need to make people aware that, you know what, this child is hurting and you can save him or her and you can give them a better life. We have to stop turning our back on those kids. They may not be your kids, but they're somebody's child. And lost or not, they need to be found.
Well, you know, let me ask you, Robert, there's a lot more, obviously, there's a lot more child education about child abuse, about victimization, about human trafficking, about sexual abuse, and about the system. Do you think it has changed? I mean, you being a victim of the system, being a victim of the lack of initiative of people to reach out and take a chance on you, do you think that it's making a difference, all of this new education? Do you think it's helping? Has it changed throughout the years?
Well, I think it's changed minimally. I think that it's been a lot of Band-Aids on a gaping wound. A lot of these people are the worst kind of predators, hide inside secure state jobs where children have no voice. As for me, I was stuck inside of a children's home, inside of a group home where I was molested by a counselor. When I stepped forward and said that I was molested by a counselor, nobody would believe me because the counselor has all the clout. And until we start doing deeper psychological evaluations on the people that are working with our children, until we make boards that make them accountable for their actions, and until the state starts prosecuting to the fullest extent of the law people who touch children in trusted positions, I don't think we're going to make a change.
You know, we're not necessarily the most forgiving nation of people. We send people to prison to pay penance for a crime, and then when they do spend their time in prisons, we make them suffer for the rest of their lives for committing a crime that they've already paid for. And yet, we can look straight-faced into the eyes of child molesters and abusers and call them neighbor, and even though something in our gut tells us something's not right, we discount it and we want to make that you pay, the person that just came out of jail, over and over and over again without educating you.
Well, you know, the thing with prison, and I've been there, so I speak from experience, is that it's a hate factory. From day one, you're taught to hate the system. You're taught to hate the world. You're locked away. You're a number. You lose all of your humanity. And if you don't do something to break that once you get out, that is how you learn to see yourself as a nothing, as a no one, as a number. And for me, I had to consciously make the decision that I'm never going back. I'm not going to be that person anymore. I'm not going to be that statistic. They're never going to get me in a cage again. Not because I'm running from the law, but because I refuse to break the law. I refuse to do anything that is going to jeopardize my freedom. I live my life according to the law now. That's something I didn't do because I didn't know how to. But I believe that recidivism is a state-caused problem as well as any other problem within the system. Rehabilitation programs are a joke. Education is inside prisons is limited. So people get out, and they give them a $21 check and tell them, now be a good boy. And that doesn't work. That just does not work for this society. They need to be welcomed back into society and realize that they can overcome that stigma. My philosophy is this. If the Philadelphia Eagles can hire somebody like Michael Vick after what he did, then nobody else should allow the fact that they're an ex-felon or a convicted person to stand in their way of accomplishing their dreams, too.
Amen. And that's been an issue that I've even had to struggle with myself as a lover of animal rights and animals. I found it very difficult for me to look at the Vic incidents with objectiveness. And I sit here, and I'm a proponent that our systems do not work, that our prisons do not work. I absolutely believe that we are not educating the people. One of the things that I found interesting about what you talk about is some of the greatest lessons you learned were not from the prison as a system, but from the prisoners themselves. So, you know, that to me was just amazing. Can you tell us, share a couple of moments that you can offhand?
Well, yeah, yes I can. When I first got to prison, I was a very, very angry man, and I acted violently. I was always in fights, always in disciplinary lockdown. And it was during one of those times after I'd been locked up for fighting with somebody that I met a guy named Steve. And Steve was an old Sioux man. He'd been locked up for 23 years. And he is one of the keys, the cornerstones of me actually realizing that, you know what, I could make a difference. He sat me down and he told me, he said, you know, this place does not have to define you. Let me introduce you to a way that when you get out, you can have a better life. This doesn't need to be for you what it is for me. And he introduced me into the Native American Sweat Lodge and the Native American community inside of the prison walls. And from there, I began a journey where I met people who had profound and significant impact on my future. And when I walked out of those prison walls, those people hugged me and they told me goodbye. And these are hardened convicts. These are guys that are serving life sentences, will never see the streets. And they told me, we don't ever want to see you back here again. And by the grace of whatever keeps it all running, I haven't been. And I am grateful to those people. I can never thank them enough for changing my life around.
So now, Robert, you're guided literally by the grace of whoever keeps things running. And you've adopted some of the Native American ways. Can you tell us about this and how you came to understand and came to peace with the spirit forces as opposed to the God that you had learned to abhor for absolutely unbelievably wonderful reasons? I mean, you were beaten by Methodist ministers. It is just unbelievable what you have faced, and here you are, like I said, being guided by the great spirit of whatever keeps everything running.
Exactly. Well, I call it great spirit, but some people, when I talk to them, I call them grandfather because of, I'm looking for wisdom. I'm looking for a way to make it through the day. And, you know, to me, the Native American culture is everything that I can embrace. Harmony with nature, harmony with one another, the beauty in a sunrise, the beauty in a sunset, respecting everything that walks on the face of this planet, and doing so in a manner that dignifies my existence. I'm so into the Native American culture, I ended up marrying a very, very beautiful Navajo woman, Rolanda, my wife. I have four children, and we are a very, very traditional Native household. I sit down by the music by the river when I meditate, and I play my flute to the sound of the river, and it's that magical moment during the day where every problem in life seems to just fade away, and I find my peace in that.
I wonder if we can convince you shortly to play a little bit on your flute.
We might be able to do that. I have it sitting here. I figured you would ask.
Well, because that's because you're absolutely amazing on it, and it is breathtaking to listen to. So maybe as we come in from the break, you can come in with the flute music. I would really appreciate that. You know, let me ask you something. One of the things that I found to be the most heart-wrenching and was part of the statement that you made at the beginning of one of the chapters, and it was, how can you know you are in darkness if you've never seen the light? For me, that statement talked about those moments, those raw moments when you said things like, I didn't know how to be honest. I didn't know how to be a law-abiding citizen. I had never been taught.
Yeah,
that is huge. That is huge.
Well, for me, any child who lives in a home where they think that abuse is a type of love, that's the darkness. And they don't even know they're living in it. And they may grow old and never know that they were living in that darkness. They may go on to abuse their children, which is the saddest part about abuse, is how cyclical it is. Because up until recently, you didn't talk about it, you know? If your dad beat you, you never said a word. If your mother beat you, you never said a word. If somebody touched you, you never said a word because it was socially taboo to even bring the subject up. So nobody told you it was wrong, and you grew up with this sick, sick, sick idea of what love is. And then you manifest that on the people that you love. And you can't actually call it relationships. It's more like hostage taking. It's more like victimizing people in the name of love. And the thing is they don't know that they're doing it. And I'm hoping, my hope and my prayer is that this book will open people's eyes and say, you know what, look, yeah, I was abused. Let me come forth now before I do more damage and deal with my demons. And that's my deepest hope for this. Many
believe that their lives as children or even as adults that they lead are normal, even if normal is being a victim of abuse. And the issue becomes, how can one even compare if there's nothing to compare it to? Growing up in the system, did you really have any role models or that many role models to show you, hey, this is what a normal life looks like and this is what you live like? You didn't have a lot of that.
No, I didn't. And I have to say that I still don't know what a normal life is. I like to think that my life is probably as normal as I can maintain. Some people measure success in how much money they have and how many cars they have, how many diamonds, how many houses. But to people who have been where I've been, success is making it through the day without the past coming up and kicking us in our face. It's not easy to exist to this day. But you have to make a conscious effort to do it. You have to wake up every morning and say, you know what? Today is going to be the best day that I can possibly make it be, regardless of what happens. And then before you go to bed, you have to learn to set it all down. You have to learn to give it all away and go to bed in peace. And I think I manage to do that more days than I don't.
Robert, you've faced a lot of bias and hate due to not only your incarceration, some of the actions that you've taken and done during your life. But let me ask you, what do you say to the people that say that you have not changed? How can someone with 25 years and out of 27, how can they change? You haven't changed.
Well, I say to them that they're talking out of their rear end. They have no clue who I was, and they have no clue who I am now. And the people who are saying these kind of things, they've obviously have not even picked up the book or attempted to read it. They're being confrontationalist. They want to minimize somebody who's actually stepped forth with a voice and said, you know what, I've been through it. I'm going to make sure you don't have to. And so I blow them up. They're insignificant people who just seek to destroy anything good in this world. And quite frankly, I want them as far away from me as I can possibly get them.
Well, I absolutely agree with you. And I think what you just said was deeply important. I think it's the minimalization of another person's path that for some reason makes people perhaps feel better about their lack of initiative in changing and in following a better way or a more sustainable way of life. And they tend to minimize or maximize whatever they look at. It's truly incredible. And I know as I said, as a survivor of many things, I know exactly. Well, no, I don't know exactly, because your life story is unbelievable. As a matter of fact, one of the statements that you made in it, you said that however horrible your life experiences were, there are others so much worse off than yourself. Now, that's a pretty hard thing to imagine, and that's very frightening, Robert, frightening to people who claim to be normal.
Well, what I say to that is this. I live in America, and because I live in America, I don't have some of the atrocities committed on me that other children have committed on them in countries that are third world, where starvation, famine, and disease are their very existence, where soldiers can come in and molest the daughters, where the peacekeepers can come in and shoot the parents. You know, these are atrocities that are far worse than anything I've ever encountered. And, you know, when I look at it, it brings tears to my eyes, because no child anywhere on this planet should ever be hurt. That's my stand on it. And I stand firm on the belief that we can save our children, but we have to do it together. We have to get back to those days where it took a village to raise a child, where we cared about our neighbor, where we cared about what was going on in our society. Instead of worrying about what Bill O'Reilly and Rush Limbaugh say, we worried about the health and welfare of our neighbor.
Absolutely. You know, we've started to get some of our questions, and I'd like to ask you this one. Sam in Pennsylvania asks, if Robert sees the foster system, the foster care system, as part of the problem, and if so, what needs to be adjusted in it to change things?
Well, the foster care system is actually, out of the three, the adoptive care, the adoptive agencies, the foster care agencies, and the state system, the foster care system is the one that has advanced the most. People no longer get kids just to get a check. Now there is a stringent psychiatric profiling done. There's a financial investigation. They want to make sure now that children who go into foster care are going into the right place, that they're not being placed into a family that has a history of abuse, that has financial difficulties, that has drug problems. So out of the three, even though it still has its problems and its failures, I would say that the foster care system is the best improved. And my heroes are the people who work to improve this system. My heroes are the people, the CASA workers, the social workers, who have that job because they care, not because it's a career.
Mm. We have another question from Kimberly in Ohio. And Kimberly asked, I think you answered a little bit of this, but maybe you can elaborate a little bit. What drove him to write the book? How long did it take to write the book? Was it years, or did it just pour out?
Well, I'll tell you what happened. I had major back surgery back in February, and I was sitting in bed for months. And I found myself being trapped more and more inside of my past. And I looked at my wife one day, and she said, you know what, I'm just going to write a book. And I sat on my laptop, and my wife fed me coffee for 5 days. I didn't sleep. And at the end of 5 days, countless boxes of Kleenexes, thousands and millions of tears, the book was written. And then I spent 4.5 months going through and editing it. But it just poured out. And I didn't realize it at the time. But as the words poured out, so did the pain. And that's that was just one of the most rewarding feelings in my life, was knowing that, you know what, I got it out. And I went ahead and I self-published it immediately so that I didn't back out of my commitment to get this book out there. And I made sure that I gave people copies right away so that it was out there. It was no longer this secret that was inside of me. And it was out. So, you know, my thing is, anything that's in that book, if you think it's ammo to use against me, well, I wouldn't have written it if it was. You know, I'm here to make sure that others don't suffer. And if my pain can help one other child, then I think I've done what I need to do.
Robert, you have children of your own. And have they, I don't know how old they are, have they been allowed to read the book yet?
Well, my 12-year-old has read the book. He thought that he somehow he had it rough. And after he read it, he was like, Jesus, Dad, I didn't even know. And my other kids are just too young to understand it. But all of a sudden, I mean, he's never been told that he's stupid. He's never been spanked. He's never been beat. According to him, he's spoiled rotten. So this was all stuff that, you know, I watched my son cry reading this book. And, you know, I had to go up and I had to hug him and I had to say, son, you know what, it's okay, it's all over. And now maybe we can help another child.
Do you think that this has changed or altered your relationship somehow with him?
I think that he now understands why his dad is so protective of him, why his dad doesn't like fighting in the house, why me and his mother never raise our voices at each other. I think that he understands now why it's so important to keep our house a safe haven.
Some people are asking for you to read a page or so out of the book. I have some of the questions that I have asked came directly from Robert's book, and it's and Robert, if you'd like to read a page or even the introduction or something briefly.
Well, I actually have a favorite part of the book.
There you go, folks. Let's have it. Go right ahead.
This is from page 114, and this is just a few short paragraphs, but they're paragraphs that that mean a lot to me. I wake up every morning, and I am grateful that I am given another day. I never even thought this was possible, and if I hadn't changed, it probably would have been an impossibility. I wake up with a smile because no matter what happens today, it can never be as bad as it was. There is no day in my life that is ever as terrible as the ones I had before. I wake up every morning and the first face I see is the most beautiful face in the world, my wife. My blessings are countless. I was stuck in a rut for so many years with no way out. I was angry, hateful, scared, and alone. I blamed the world for my situation and I did everything I could to run from the truth. The truth is that terrible things happen, and they can never be an excuse to justify the things I have done. I am responsible for my actions, just as others are accountable for theirs. I have learned that in order to be alive, I have to let it all go. Holding on to the pain serves no purpose, yet it is so hard to let it go. It has been my constant companion for so long. What will we do once that pain is gone? How will we fill the void? Well, herein lies the secret. Live right. And I think that's a very, very powerful
Bravo.
Part. I mean, you have to learn to put it all behind.
Well, it's amazing, and I think that says it all itself. Live right. How does a child live right when the world is dead set on forcing him to live wrong is what this book is about, ladies and gentlemen. So I highly recommend you go and get a copy of this, and you can go to the site www.itendswithme.com. There you can read more about Robert and his how he's come to be where he is today. We're going to take a short break now, and maybe when we come back, we'll also have a moment to hear your lovely flute that has helped you through some very, very perilous times.
Well, I'll be here waiting on the other side.
Okay, folks, we'll be back in a minute.
In our Constitution, the Founding Fathers laid a path to an economy that should have kept Americans free and prosperous. How We the People Were Tricked Off That Path into a World of Debt and Deception reads like one of the great mystery novels of all time. American Free Press compares author Ellen Brown's new book, Web of Debt, to an eye-opening thriller that will leave you feeling like Neo in the Matrix. In Web of Debt, the mysterious and often shocking origins of today's ultimate financial crisis are exposed, starting with its distant beginnings to its present disastrous climax as the reader is shown that the way to restore America's true wealth has been with us all along. Please visit Ellen Brown's website, webofdebt.com, to see how America's money and future can become by and for the people once again.
It Ends With Me, a new book by author Robert Allen Savage, a child abuse survivor, has opened deep in ancient wounds to share his spirit of survival with those who are still being wounded. This he does that no other child should linger in suffering alone. He speaks to children, to parents, and to the system that still looks down a long path in the care of our most precious gift, our children. To order a copy of It Ends With Me, please visit it-ends-with-me.com.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact the world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Join the World March for Peace and Nonviolence, an international three-month event spanning seven continents and over 1 million participants, with endorsements from luminaries worldwide such as President Jimmy Carter, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and Archbishop Desmond Tutu. The World March for Peace and Nonviolence seeks to bring attention to the need to end war and occupation, reduce arms spending, and all forms of violence. Please visit theworldmarch.org.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the city wall, by the relief fortress, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me.
How's that?
It was fantastic. I hope everybody enjoyed that. That beautiful flute music. It was just amazing. Thank you. Thank you. Welcome back, everyone. We're here with Robert Allen Savage, and he just played the flute for all of us. It was just amazing. Robert, it really was breathtaking. And I know that music and writing are very cathartic in the healing process for many reasons and for many people. As a writer myself, I know I have volumes and volumes of writing. And to be quite honest with you, I think that was probably the thing that I most appreciate is that you have done things that a lot of people can't do. You have put it out there. You have put everything in your soul and in your spirit, all the pain and the suffering of your life, all of the abuse, all of the direct actions on your own part, however victim-based they were, but they were all made not by your own choice. That you were forced into a life that, and all you wanted to do was escape. Is that correct?
Yeah, I don't think that a child says, you know what, at 13 years of age, I want to be a drug addict. At 15 years of age, I want to be involved in child prostitution in San Francisco. I don't think those are decisions that kids make. I don't think a kid says, you know what, I sure hope my dad takes a 2x4 to my feet today. I mean, these are things that are forced on children who are in these situations, and they end up in places not by their own choice, but by circumstance, because all they want to do is escape. That's all they want to do. They want to leave that life. And the sad thing about it is some end up where I ended up, but a lot of them end up in the morgue. And there is nothing more tragic than knowing that a child's life was so messed up that he thought the only solution was to end it all. And it breaks my heart when I hear those kind of things. When I look on the news and I see, you know, I have a friend, Beth. She came home to her 8-year-old son had committed suicide, hung himself in the closet. This is horrific. And the thing is that people walked by these children and they saw the broken eyes. They saw the child in pain and they did nothing. They did nothing.
I think that's part of the problem. A lot of people will look at a convict or a prisoner or someone on parole and they'll think, oh, wow, you know, what a loser. In fact, we're the losers here in a country that has the highest incarceration rate on the planet, just for those of you that don't know. We are, and what are we doing with them? I mean, truly, do these people feel re-educated? Do they feel that they have been given the tools to help guide them into a successful way or methodology of living a relatively normal, whatever normal means? And I'm like you. I pray I never am normal because, you know, if normal is allowing children to get lost in the system, allowing children to be abused and turning your back on them, or not even nurturing the feelings that we have within us that say, hey, something's not right here, and we doubt ourselves over and over and over again. Why do you think that is, Robert? Why do we doubt ourselves?
Well, I think we doubt ourselves because we've never been secure. You know, we've gone through our lives, and for me, for so many years, every single decision that I made had a bad ending. So I learned to think that every decision I ever made was wrong. Well, I don't know how you're supposed to be confident when everything you do seems to have gone terribly awry. And you're sitting there, and like I said, I was sitting there at 20 years old. I'm sitting there and I'm facing a trigger-happy district attorney who wants to push for the death penalty. And I'm 20 years old, and I'm sitting there and my head's spinning, and I'm like, see, this is what every decision I ever made led me to. And I was destroyed. I mean, that's why we doubt ourselves, because we've been so damaged for so long that even when we know the right thing, sometimes we still question whether we have what it takes inside of us to do that. And you brought up the incarceration rate. The incarceration rate should be nowhere near as scary as the recidivism rate, which is about 87% to 92%, depending on the state you go to. That is an atrocious number. That shows us that we as a society are doing nothing right with our justice system.
Not only with our justice system, but with our educational system within the system. It's atrocious. It really is. We've had many guests on our shows that have addressed this issue. And it is beyond the imagination that we here in the United States of America that claim to have this hierarchical position and we are better than thou attitude. And yet, look, as you said, the rate of reoffense and return offenders into the system over and over and over again is beyond the imagination, and it's inexcusable. That alone should show us that this is not working, and what we're doing is just not working. Now, you know, we have a question from Jeanette in Michigan. Robert, we have talked about this before. Share with the audience the importance of encouraging other voices to be added to yours.
Well, because these subjects have been so taboo for so long, and they've been what I call brush under the carpet topics, the more voices we have, the louder we yell, the more power we have behind the voices that are coming out to speak, the more people who hear them and say, you know what, I need to speak up too, the sooner we can reach a point where we can start doing something to reverse this mentality that says walk on by, this mentality that says, oh, that child's hurting, but it's not my child, it's none of my business. We got to end this mentality of what other people think of me is none of my business. We have to get enough voices to affect change. If one guy stands on the street corner and screams at the policeman, you gotta let us pass, you gotta let us pass, he's never gonna get across that street. If there's 1,000 voices on that corner yelling at that police officer, we've gotta get across, we've gotta get across, well, now you've affected change. And that's what we need to do. We need to get enough voices out there to stop this madness.
Are you involved in any groups that are working towards changing legislation, changing the system to be more conducive to helping children come forward without and be protected at the same time?
Well, I'm working with a couple of people here locally that are CASA workers. They're currently in the process of reading the book and seeing what we can do about local options for abused children, because they're very limited here. I'm also working with some other people with some suicide prevention monologues that will be given out free as a complimentary thing to go with my book. So that, you know, people understand that, you know, it starts with the children. And what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to get a network up of resources, a website up that's safe for children, so that children can come on there and they can say, you know what, I can't tell anybody in my house, I can't tell any of my family, I can't tell any of my friends, but here's what happened, help me.
Can I ask you why there is not, I mean, as many children in this country that are left alone to their own devices, and the majority of them end up just sitting there like lumps on a couch watching television, why are there not more numbers or advertisements geared to these children? I have very rarely ever seen an ad on television or on the radio that offers an option for children in their voices, in their own voices. And I wonder why that is.
Well, it's really easy. The media loves people like Rush Limbaugh. They love people like Sean Hannity. They love the disruptors. They love the people who cause chaos and whine and moan about a system that's trying to change, but they don't want to see it change. Because what the children have to say isn't as important and doesn't sell as well. They don't have to pay children a $9 million a year contract to see their pain. You can see that by walking down the street. The media has its own criteria all messed up, what's important. They need to get off of Rush Limbaugh and start worrying about little Susie, little Jonathan, the kids who are lost in the world, and they need to bring those kids to the forefront and put people like Rush Limbaugh and the Sean Hannitys and the Lou Dobbs and the Rachel Maddows, put them on a back burner where their opinion is no longer heard, and we can start taking care of issues that truly matter in this world.
Amen. You know, I guess I never thought about that, but if we get rid of all of the criminals and all of the child killers and the child abusers, well, what would we put on sensationalist television? We wouldn't have a whole hell of a lot to talk about, would we?
It'd be reruns of Leave It to Beaver.
Absolutely. That is just amazing. Let me ask you, what advice do you offer to those suffering now, Robert?
Speak up. Speak up in a voice that nobody can deny, and don't stop talking. Talk to anybody that's qualified to listen to you. Talk to anybody that will hear your voice. Don't sit there in your pain and think you're all alone. Because once you start opening your mouth and you start letting that pain out, somebody who's been where you've been will take your hand and they will show you a way out of that pain and a way into a healthy life. And they will help you affect those changes that mean that you never, ever have to hurt somebody in the name of love the way that somebody did it to you.
And, you know, one of the things that you addressed in the book is that it seems that the biggest feat is to convince people that these children are telling the truth. Do you feel that in today's society that we're more apt to believe these things happen more now than we did at one time, Robert?
Well, I think we are to a point. I mean, I think we're allowed to believe that it happens on TV. I think we're allowed to believe that it happens in the town over. I still think that there's a huge social stigma when it hits your front door. You know what I'm saying? I think that you're willing to believe it. Parents are willing to believe it. Teachers are willing to believe it right up until it's on their front doorstep. And then all of a sudden it's back to that, well, that could never happen here mentality.
You know, not only can it not happen here, and you said it yourself, when it comes to your front doorstep, and this is something that I think a lot of people forget, and having worked with groups on this very issue for a number of years, some of the stories that I heard were the worst offenders and the worst non-believers were generally the parents of these children. You know, they went to the other parent in many cases, especially in the issues of sexual abuse. And the mother or the father, whoever it may have been at the time, beat them for even saying such a thing.
Yeah,
And this is your family. So once you experience that kind of personification of the abuse, well, then where do you go from there?
Well, I don't know what to say to that because I didn't ever have anybody, any family that to turn to. You know, this is that point where I start losing connection because this is an issue that I never had. I feel terrible for any child who went to a relative and said what happened and got beat for it. That is unforgivable. And in my eyes, the person who beat them for it is just as guilty as the person who abused them sexually or physically or however they were abused. They're both just as guilty. They're guilty by just ignoring it. And you can't ignore a child's pain.
I agree. I absolutely agree. You know, we have a question from Grace in Florida. And Grace asks, what organizations or agencies would you refer victims of abuse to?
Well, first and foremost, I would recommend that anybody who reports anything, start at CASA. Go to CASA, which is the Court-Appointed Special Advocates Program, and start there. Because those people, I cannot praise what they do enough. And they don't care about red tape. They don't care about being silent. They don't care about anything except protecting that child. from there, CASA usually has a million resources to help people get where they need to go to make sure that that child's safe. And I preach CASA because they are the people who get the kids after they're damaged. They're the ones who get the kids after they've been in an abusive relationship. And the last thing in the world they want to do, it's CASA, CASA, Court-Appointed Special Advocates. The last thing they want to do is see another file come across their desk from a kid that they know they could have done something about. And so as far as I'm concerned, if you have the number for your CASA worker, your CASA in your neighborhood or in your community, that's the very best resource to start with.
I'm sure there's probably a CASA.com somewhere, too, that people can look up on the Internet. You know, Robert, the last part of the book was more like a letter almost to the children of abuse than it was a reason for healing. Or do you think, in some way it was more a letter to yourself?
I think it's both. I think that in writing it, I was able to trace my own footsteps towards ending the cycle. I think that through that, I was able to say in a loud voice, hey, it does end with me. It does. No child in my life will ever be abused. I will never walk by and see a broken child and not make a call. Hey, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But if I'm right, then thank God I made that call. I can't risk being wrong. I don't want to be the guy who went through all of this and professed to all of this change and towards protecting the children and then see a child walk by me, go home, sit down and watch the news and see that child's face on the news. That's not the person I want to be. That would break my heart. And so I think it was a twofold thing. I think it was a letter to those who still suffer. And I think that it was the final chapter in me being able to say, you know what, thank God it's over.
You know, it's amazing, and I had an incident just a couple of days ago at my place of business. A woman came in, and I happened to notice her T-shirt had a couple of angel wings and a little girl and a baby on either side of the wings. Not really paying attention to the wings, I just assumed it was grandmother's T-shirt. You know how there are a lot of grandmothers, and I thought, oh, that's so cool, because for me, it's all about my grandchildren. And she sat down and she said, yeah, it is. She said, these are pictures of Nevaeh. Do you know Nevaeh in Monroe, who was murdered? And this is a young girl that was just killed recently here in Michigan. And, well, as soon as she said that, I just broke down into tears. I couldn't even believe that I hadn't even paid enough attention to the children, just assuming they were her grandchildren. And one of the things she said was, and for those of you that are familiar with Nevaeh's story, she was buried alive, a five-year-old child. And the word, the name Nevaeh is heaven spelled backwards, for those of you that don't know that either. And her concern was that they were going to, there was going to be a memorial at the place of this child's death. And I think, and for me, the interesting thing was gosh, you know, I guess I had never thought about that before, but look at how we memorialize these horrid events instead of shrieking out an atrocity and changing the system and the way it works and having these perpetrators come and be. Can I ask you briefly, Robert, have any of your perpetrators ever been brought to task on what their abuse of you?
To this day? No, and that's interesting because I was dealing with the Tucson Police Department the other day, and I was informed that my case is no longer prosecutable. Even though there is no statute of limitations on child molestation, they said the one thing that rings true in about 95% of all child molestation cases. We can't prosecute because it's my word against their word.
Mm-hmm.
Well, isn't that the way it always is?
Yeah, and then we can, what, prosecute them after they bury a child alive? I don't know. This is just a crazy. And one more question before I'm going to ask you to, upon our exiting from the show tonight, which has been just a profound show. I want to thank you for being with us. Let me ask you, how do you learn to trust after all of these terrible experiences?
Well, I think my trust is multi-leveled. I trust some people more than I trust others. I trust my wife with my life. It's not easy. I still have not given up. Even after what I've been through, I still have not given up on mankind. I like to think that there is good in people. I like to think that through what I've been through, I've become a good enough judge of character that I can actually, you know, see whether a person's agenda is that of somebody I'd actually want something to do with. As a result, I have very, very few friends. The people that I trust, well, they're few and they know who they are. Outside of that, I take the world one person at a time, and I don't give trust. Trust is earned. and I see that it's getting close to that time. So what I would like to do at this point, Vixie, is I would like to say thank you. I've listened to your show. You do wonderful work. You do make a difference in this world. And if there were more people like you, then this world would be a better place.
Well, thanks, but I can only give the credit to my guests, Robert. They make my job easy, and what I've learned and what I've gained from this experience is, believe me, a lot more than I can put out there. It takes a conjoined effort, and I appreciate you and all of my other guests that have been so vocal in what they say. Next week, Chris Wells, the U.S. spokesman for the World March for Peace and Nonviolence, will be our guest. That's August 25th. Ladies and gentlemen, for those of you that don't know, Robert Allen Savage is a hero, and he wrote the book, It Ends With Me, so you can go and get it at www.itendswithme.com. Robert, would you mind playing some music for us on your flute as we leave tonight?
Sure, I'll take us on out. Thank you, Vic.
Thank you.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the city wall, by the relief of the I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours, land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land was made for you and me.